7. I am your host. They call me the Booker, Jeff Bowdrum. With me, the man I call the women's pet, the men's regret, the grandmaster, the 3MGs. He rocks the house for the young ladies, the Ambler Rambler. He's down in his basement right now, and that hand and that hand lotion is running out quickly. Barry Rose, how you doing, my man?
Well, that's accurate. there's no disputing anything you just said right there.
There is a blizzard on the way.
Yeah. Well, all the more reason to get more of the hand lotion down here with rolls of paper towels, but I love that. Hey, let me ask you a question. Is your mom listening this week, Jeff, that you would break that out?
Let's hope not. So anyway, on this particular episode, special edition, as aren't they all, Barry, special editions of Breaking Kayfabe. You know, first of all, we're going to be taking a look. We are going into the 2000s for our match of the week. Whoa, yes. Some of the boys on the group, the Facebook group, will be extremely excited to hear about that. As well, Barry and I will be looking at a recent documentary that's still on Showtime called The Comedy Store. And we're going to be having a special guest from Hollywood. Well, actually, she lives in Vegas, I guess. But one of the people featured on the show is the great Marsha Warfield. You know her. You love her from Night Court. That's right, Barry. For the first time since William Forsythe's appearance, we're going to be having an actual celebrity on here with us on Breaking Kayfabe about it. And Barry, besides that, we're going to be talking, a little F, Mary, or Kill. Might drop a dime or two about last week's AEW show. I have some thoughts. I will share them with you. Somebody else uses that line. I can't remember who, Barry. So, and a couple of various other and sundry little messages. Barry, you about ready to go?
This sounds like an eight-hour show. Is this like the special 8 hour as we ramp up for Christmas spectacular, Jeff?
Well, you know, every episode is special, Barry. I
mean, that's really true. That's true.
So let's start off with a little couple personal notes from your beloved, Barry loves it when I say this, from your fearless leader. And you know, I'll get a little fucking note from Barry. Fearless leader, really?
What the fuck do you mean, fearless leader?
So first of all, I want to give a shout out to the boys from Louisville, or as Jim Cornette used to call it, Louisville. They sent me a very nice little care package. Also got a little care package from Travis. Did you get a package from Travis Range, Bear?
I didn't get Travis Range. Louisville.
Yeah.
Well, I did get some from Travis. Travis was part of the group that sent me two Lou Malnati's pizzas.
Yeah. Well, fuck those guys, because I didn't get any pizza. That's all I'm going to say.
What'd you get? Wait, what was your little package?
I'm not going to mention. Please don't talk about my little package. It's why I've been married 3 times. But anyway, so also kind of wanted to mention a couple other things. So thank you to the boys from Louisville, by the way.
Thank you to everybody that's been sending.
Yes, absolutely. Very gracious and very
There's
nice.
There's a lot, though.
I want to give a special little Breaking Kayfabe about and very shout out to our mutual friend, Oben Johnson. Oben continues to struggle with his cancer. He posts pictures every couple of weeks, and you usually see a picture of Oben tied up to the device that's dispensing the chemo and stuff like that. And he did another report recently, and it got me thinking that we haven't given Oben a shout out. Oben, we love you, and we're rooting for you, and I know you're going to do you're just going to kick this cancer's ass like I did, and we're pulling for you, buddy. Barry, I know you've met Oben before. Great guy.
You know what? He's a real sweet guy, too. And, you know, that's the beauty. And if you look at our Facebook group, the evolution of our Facebook group since we started it 3.5 years ago to what it is today, it's a group that you can go in and have a shitload of fun, whether it's you post sports multiple times per day. There's food, there's wrestling, there's women, but it's also a support group. And, you know, everybody is there to support other people. And, you know, Oben is a guy, I believe, Jeff, is this his second round of cancer?
I believe so. Yes.
Yeah. Sweet guy. Definitely doesn't deserve this shit, but he's got the heart of a lion, the heart of a champion. He is fighting and, you know, he's got several thousand people in his corner. And I absolutely just love that.
Yeah. And Oben, of course, for those of you who do not know, one of the original boys from Front Row Section D in Greensboro, along with John Hitchcock and Bruce Mitchell and some other guys. So, Oben, well, you are in our thoughts, my man. Go out there and put the boots to cancer the way that Tully used to put the boots to Dusty when you guys would cheer him on there in Front Row Greensboro. So, Barry, before we get started, I want to ask you about something. And I reached out to you privately and asked you if Ozzy was the first dog you'd ever owned. And the reason I asked this was recently in my memories, you know, every day Facebook pops up some sort of memory from a few years back. And it happened to be the 10-year anniversary of what I like to refer to as possibly the worst day in my entire life. And that was the day that we lost my beloved Midnight, my Border Collie mix. It had been a rough couple of months. We lost our, we had a Yellow Lab Golden Retriever mix named Beezer, and Beezer passed away, and he was old. He was starting to have some hip dysplasia problems. And so we were sad, but not completely shocked. And then the day that Midnight died, and I'm not kind of, I'm not meaning to start this off on a real downer here, but, you know, I know a lot of people in our group, when we mention dogs and we talk about dogs, we'll post pictures of their dogs. So I don't know if I'd ever shared the story with the group about the night that I lost Midnight. I came home and my son had gotten home before me and he said, you know, I think there's something wrong with Midnight, Dad. Now, at the time, we'd gone from three dogs because we lost Beezer down to Midnight and a girl dog named Jazzy. And Jazzy was a Shiba Inu mix. If you don't know what a Shiba Inu is, Google it. And so so Jazz is sort of sitting off by herself away from Midnight. Midnight's under the dining room table. And I go over and, yeah, I'm thinking, no, maybe he threw up or something. He had a little stomach ache. And I said, hey, what's the matter, buddy? And I looked and his eyes were like just completely glazed over. There was like nothing there. And I knew immediately that something was really, really wrong. And we'd had Midnight for about 10 years. And, you know, much like you with Ozzy, me with Gunny now and with other dogs, you know, where you just latch onto a dog and it's just like you're running buddy, you know, you go to the store for something and the dog goes with you. You go on a road trip and the dog goes with you. And so Midnight, out of all our dogs, he was my running buddy. And he was just the silliest dog. I always tell people the story that he would come in from outside and he'd start running around the house like he was chasing something. And then all of a sudden he'd stop and he'd look at you and he'd start breathing heavy like he was laughing, you know, like he was just doing it because, you know, just because he felt like doing it. And so on this day, I got Andy to help me. We put Midnight in the car and we took him down the street. The animal hospital was only about, maybe a half mile away. And, you know, we had brought all our dogs there for the better part of almost 15 years. And we brought him in and we said, you know, we don't know what's wrong with him, but he looks like catatonic. And so we bring him in. They said, we're going to take a look at him. They bring him in. About half an hour go by and we're in one of the little rooms they take you in when your dog's getting treated. And the guy comes in and he has a piece of paper in his hand. Now it's not the regular doctor that we usually dealt with. Okay. It was like one of the assistants. He says, okay. He says, here's what we're looking at. Now, mind you, this is approximately 2.5 weeks before Christmas. Okay. He hands me a sheet of paper and it's an estimate on there. And the estimate was to treat Midnight. It was going to cost just south of $3,500. And I looked at the guy and I went, what are you fucking kidding me? $3,500 fucking dollars? Are you out of your mind? Do you know that's 2.5 weeks till Christmas time? Do you really think I got $3,500 to spend on my dog? And the guy goes, oh, we'll just put him on some, where they hydrate you.
What's that called? An Icon IV drip?
Yes. We'll hook him up to an IV and get him some fluids. That's the word I'm looking for.
Okay.
So I said, okay. And so, so the doctor came in, she says, you know, we really don't know what's wrong with him. But we're going to keep him here. We're going to look at him and take, you know, and keep good care of him and see what's going on, run some tests on him. I said, look, I ain't got $3,500 to spend on him. I said, good Lord, I wasn't expecting this. And I was really pissed off because this was not the first time I've been to this facility. You know, if I was a first time customer coming in out of the dark, my dog had never been there, I would completely understand them having to do this. But I was a customer for over 10 years. Okay. I hate to put it that way, but that's what I was. I was a customer for over 10 years. And so, a few hours go, and of course, before I left, I went back to the back. I petted him. I said, hey buddy, you know, get better. We love you. Da, da, da. And we left. And then about 10 o'clock, we get a phone call. My wife answered it. And she's like, okay. Okay. And she says, the doctor needs to talk to you. And I said, okay. So I get on the phone and, you know, I can feel the lump in my throat starting. I'm going to get some sort of bad news. And she says, I need to know whether you want us to do what we have to do to keep him alive. And I said, what? And I got to tell you, Barry, it's been over 10 fucking years and I'm getting chills just talking about it right now. And she said, he's fading. He's fading very fast. And we need, you know, if you want to do something to keep him alive, you need to tell us now. Now I'm going to interrupt here for just a second to say something to anybody that's a pet owner, whether it's a dog, cat, or whatever. You have a responsibility to your pet. Your pet will give you 10 to 15 years of tremendous enjoyment and love. And then at the end, you have a responsibility to your pet to do what's right by your pet. And sometimes that means saying goodbye when you don't want to. You cannot be selfish and let them linger when they don't have a say in it. And it's brutal to sit there and watch an animal. I hate to even say be euthanized, because what they do is they give them a shot first that essentially numbs them, so they don't feel anything. And they just slowly, as the vets will say, go to sleep. And that's what happens. And I've been there for a couple of pets where it's happened. And so I told her, I said, well, you know, and the other thing I want to mention before I talk about what she said to me, you have to understand what your pet's quality of life is. You know, my wife had a cat. Barry, I don't know if I've ever told you this. Her cat lived 25 friggin' years. She got the cat when she was in high school. And when I met my wife, she still had the cat. It's just crazy to think she had the, and eventually she had to say goodbye to the cat. And it was extremely painful for her because that's something that had been part of her life other than like her parents and her brother longer than anybody else in her entire life. So anyway, so the vet says, I need to know what I need to do. And so then I made the incredibly, incredibly difficult decision to let my dog Midnight go. And I said, you need I need to let him go. And she told me, she said, he's already gone. And 10 years later, I can still remember the anguish because I literally let out a cry that was almost feral in nature. I was so heartbroken that my friend, my companion, my running mate had been taken from me before it was really his time. Cause he was maybe 10 years old. Cause we'd got him from like the city pound or whatever, you know, because we're not ones that buy dogs that are bred. And by the way, neither should you, if you're listening to this show, you should always go to a shelter to get your animal, but that's another story for another time. But anyway, so my little buddy that I had for 10 years was gone, and I literally was on the floor crying as my wife just held me and did what she could for me to get through this. It was the saddest day. It impacted me more, I think, than when my grandmother died. You know, I was so heartbroken. And then I went a couple of days later to get his effects, you know, his collar, his dog tags and such from the animal hospital. I let the vet that had treated him for 10 years know exactly what I think about their little financial policy about, you know, basically holding people up and saying, well, yeah, we can treat him if you give us $3,500. I said, that's fucking bullshit. You'll never see my face in this building again. And I own pets. And we've had pets for the last 10 years, and we never once went back to that facility because I just thought that was complete horseshit. End of the story. We found out that Midnight had a tumor that was behind his heart. There was nothing that they could have done. And truthfully, to be fair to the vet, they did not know that until after Midnight died, when they went in and they found what killed him was the tumor that was behind his heart that eventually had burst. And that's what killed him. So a bad anniversary for the Booker, to be sure. Not only during this pandemic time, you know, when people say hold your family tight, keep your family and friends close, your pets. If you're any sort of pet lover, like we here at Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry are, just, you know, give your dog or your cat a little extra love and a little extra hug. Maybe give them that little extra snack tonight, Bear.
Oh, that's it's heartbreaking. And, you know, when you reached out to and we were talking about it, I grew up as a baby. My parents had a dog, but I was never close because I was a baby. So I didn't fully get it. And then I had, because I was transient and moving around so much throughout much of my life, I never had a dog. I did have cats. and I had a cat that passed away in 2011. And I got to tell you, I, as you just said, I was with her as she transitioned over, and I stayed with her, and I was telling her that everything was going to be all right. And when I knew that she couldn't see me any longer, I burst out in tears. I was crying. And one of the nurse's aides started crying with me. I think my pain was that obvious that it was there. And I loved my cat. This is a cat that we rescued, much like Mr. Noodles. And it was a cat that would climb up on the bed and then go to sleep on my chest. And she had had a rough life. She didn't have any teeth. They had to pull it because of disease. But I never forget, because I would scratch her head and I would pet her, and all the drool would come out of her mouth because she had no teeth to catch it. And it would be all over me, but I never cared. You know, it was one of those things when you love your pets, if you truly are a pet lover. And as you said, you know, I've lost both of my parents, and that's very traumatic, obviously, to anybody that's ever lost a parent. But I got to tell you, I kid, but it's not joking, that when Ozzy passes, I'm going to have to go into some form of therapy. Like, it's not, because Ozzy is not just, he's not just a dog. He is my best friend, and he has been my best friend. And there have been moments, you know, where my life, there are challenges, and Ozzy is a support dog in a sense. It's certainly not what he was trained or anything like that. And it's not like I can bring him on a plane and call him an emotional support dog, but he is. And that's really the main thing. And there's not a day that goes by, you know, I'm the one that feed, and partially because Ozzy is almost 100 pounds, I'm the one that walks him, you know, 4 times a day. And I have been since he's been a puppy. He is with me by my side. You know, he sleeps literally 2 feet from me every single day. And, you know, when I go out of town, I'll call the house, and, you know, it's usually like, how's Zach, Zoe, how's Ozzy? You know, like, or sometimes, how's Ozzy, how's Zach and Zoe? But yeah, he's literally, right. You know, there's no differentiating between my three children. You know, there's just no, and you know it as a dog person. I will tell you, I know how much you love Gunny. I know how much you love Molly. And a big concern for me was what was going to happen when Ozzy passes. Would I ever, and it's probably maybe something that every true first time dog owner thinks about, but you know, I was going, I don't know if I can ever get another dog. Because I don't know if I'll ever have that. And I don't think I'll ever have the relationship with another dog that I have, but that's okay. But there are times when I might take Ozzy and drop him off at the groomer, and the house is silent. Not now with Mr. Noodles, obviously, but previously it was silent. And you know, you would always expect if somebody knocks on the door that you're going to hear the barking, you know. And then there are times where, you know, Ozzy, I'm in the basement, as we joke about a lot. It's true though, but I'm in the basement a lot, but there are wood floors above me. So when Ozzy walks, you can hear his nails on the wood. And if I couldn't hear these sounds, it would be an extremely lonely world for me. You know, it would be tremendously lonely. So I feel your pain. I respect your pain. Because it's so from the heart. It's so legitimate. It's so real and so honest. And, you know, you've made some great points. Your point about don't go out and buy a dog. You know, first off, let me say, Mr. Ozzy, Ozzy's a great story, Jeff. And I think I told you, because we were talking about people that buy dogs. Ozzy's mother is a black and white standard poodle, and his father was a chocolate English lab, and they're both big, big dogs. And the owner, who was a neighbor of my sister-in-law, claimed that her dog, she had the poodle, got impregnated by accident by this other dog. I don't quite believe accident, but she would go horseback riding twice a week. And the owner of the stables had the lab. She brought the poodle. They would play. Well, they fucked at one point.
That's generally how it works.
That's exactly how it works. And 7 puppies were born. So when my kids for years were, let's get a dog. And I resisted it because I knew that that responsibility was going to fall on me. And let's be honest, I've done everything in my life to avoid responsibility as best as humanly possible. And if you're smart, you'll do that as well, people, if you're listening. But with that, I resisted the dog, but it took me 48 hours where I said, this might be the best decision I've ever made. And he has become, and I should say too, we gave Ozzy to the kids on Christmas Day. It was Christmas Day 2013. We gave them a photo and we said, this is your new dog. We're going to pick him up in 1 hour. And both kids broke down in tears immediately. And that was unbelievable to see. And then we showed up at the woman's house and you know, she was giving us this puppy. Like there was no cost involved. There was nothing. We brought her a bottle. And people say, how much you pay for Ozzy? And I'm like, a $14 bottle of wine. We gave her a bottle.
It wasn't $6,500. Is that what you're saying?
it's insane because let me tell you, your money that you might, and Jeff is referencing somebody that he knows that I'm aware of that paid $6,500 for a dog. You have no idea what this dog is no better than any dog in the pound. And when people say, oh, I've got to get this type of dog and I'll pay any amount of money. I'm like, you know, you have no fucking idea. It's like saying, I don't love my child. I gave birth to a child, but I don't love it because it doesn't have blonde hair or its eyes aren't blue enough. You know, what the fuck? There are amazing animals and dogs in every shelter, and you can go out and pay, as Jeff said, $6,500, and you may get a total fucking psycho asshole dog. Though there really are no psycho asshole dogs, right, Jeff?
My daughter has one that's pretty close. I got
it. It does happen occasionally, but a lot of it is, again, you know. But you want to go to a shelter. You want to rescue a dog. Some of the conditions in some of these facilities are horrific, and I got to tell you, Mr. Noodles, I have fallen in love with this dog. He's totally different than Ozzy. There's no comparison on, you know, Ozzy. I can look at Ozzy and I don't have to say anything, and Ozzy knows exactly what I'm thinking. Mr. Noodles is a quote unquote dog, but he's so much fun and I enjoy him. And I got to tell you, he was close to death because he was having medical issues and the clinic was not prepared to treat him. They were going to put him to sleep. And we rescued him and we saved his life. And every day that I spend with him and every day he kisses me, he just loves to jump on my lap and kiss me. I'm so grateful that he came into our lives.
Barry, if only our wives did that. You know, I keep asking my wife to do that.
Yeah, just, right. Exactly. The women we fantasize about. But
exactly.
Yeah, but at that stage. But, you know, that's the difference, too, because, you know, your life compared to my life has been a little more structured going back. You held a job for 33 years, if I'm correct. You've had dogs, you know, certainly, look, you married 40 times. I get it. But at the same time, you know, you went and did a job for over 30 years. You've had dogs. Because I moved around, I wasn't in the same situation, but the love, it's immeasurable. You can't even quantify it. It is something that is completely so. When I listened to you, I teared up, Jeff, when I was listening to you recount because I felt your pain. Though I've never experienced it with a dog, I know it's going to come one day, obviously, and I dread it. And I almost cry just thinking about it. So I give you my support. Yeah.
Thank you. A couple things real quick just before we move on to the rest of the old episode here.
Lighter, right?
This will be a little lighter. It probably can't help but be. So when I was 10 years old, my parents and myself were living in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. My dad was in the Navy. For those of you that don't know Guantanamo is where they keep the Al-Qaeda guys now that are still in custody. And it's been a naval base for, good Lord, I don't know, 60-something years. My dad was in the Navy. So my dad decided that every 10-year-old boy needs a dog. Apparently did not decide that when my brother was 10 years old, but he decided to, I guess, because, my older brother and sister had gone on to my brother, I think, was in the service and my sister was in college and I was there just, you know, I was the only kid left in the house. So they said we needed a dog. My mom said, okay, but it's gotta be a short haired male because I don't want a dog getting pregnant, having puppies, and I don't want to be cleaning up any dog fur. Famous last words, you know? So naturally, we got a long-haired female that my dog rescued. And I've had dogs, with the exception of, I want to say about a two-year period, I've, in the last 49 years, had dogs every year, except like a two-year period before I married my second wife. And every one of them has been special to me. I loved every one of them. And when I lost Midnight, to get back to the story that I initially started telling, I was in a position that you just talked about. I can't get another dog. It's going to be too stinking hard, you know, like, to go through that again. And, you know, my wife said, okay, you know, but if you want, let me know. And so, we went, and, about 3 weeks went by, you know, we actually went on vacation. We came back and my wife said, are you ready yet? I said, yeah, let's go. And so we went to, a no-kill shelter, in South Florida. And so we were walking around and my daughter was with us and she was in high school at the time. And she said, well, what about this one? What about that one? And then we're looking and I'm like, nah. So we come across this kennel run and the dog is sitting way in the back of the kennel run. Not, you know, all the other dogs are coming up to the gate and they're barking or they're trying to get your attention or something like that. And this dog is way in the back of the kennel run. I'm looking at him and he's not, I'm like, come on, you got to come up and sell yourself, my man, come on. And he's looking at me and he's not doing anything. And so I said, well, okay, let me keep walking. So I went to keep walking and something told me to stop. And I stopped and I leaned my head back and I did the old Scooby-Doo line, you know, that's my best Scooby-Doo. And the dog suddenly perked its head up, the ears cropped up and he came walking towards me. So I said, let's take this one out for a walk, see how he does. And it came down to that particular dog and another dog. And we liked them both so much. And here again, let me just tell you people that are out there looking for purebreds. The other dog that I was looking at was a purebred pointer. So, you know, you go into a kennel or a ASPCA or a shelter, there are purebred dogs in there. Don't be so, you know, fool yourself that, oh, I got to get me a full, you know, full blooded this or that. Those dogs are out there at a shelter and you're going to pay a couple thousand less than you'd pay by going through a breeder. Okay. So we were going to take both the dogs and then the lady at the checkout register says, oh, you know about this dog, don't you? And she pointed to the paperwork on the pointer. And I said, what? She says, well, that dog's had two bites. He likes to go after people that are jogging. So my wife and I looked at one another and go, well, guess we're getting one then, you know, because we couldn't risk, because we couldn't risk it and stuff like that. So my point is the story that we ended up with, the dog we ended up with was Gunny. And that's how Gunny came into my life. And I always say that Gunny rescued me from the depths of despair when I had lost my Midnight. And so that's what Gunny gave to me. One other quick little story on how you pass that love for animals down to your children. My daughter is a vet technician at a local 24-hour emergency care place here, excuse me, by where we live. And my daughter rescued a cat a couple months ago. Somebody brought it in and said, you know, oh my God. And the kitten at the time was a month, 6 weeks old. And it appeared to have been hit by a car, okay, or something. The two back legs were not working. When the cat would get up, she would drag her legs, okay? I'm just telling you the story because I want to tell you how I was able to pass down love for animals to my daughter. My daughter still has that cat. She adopted the cat. Little trivia contest for you. The cat's name is Dick Grayson. Barry, you know the reference?
Dick Grayson, yes, that is from Batman.
That's Robin the Boy Wonder's name.
Yes.
And so she, and their other cat's name is Batman, so she named this cat Dick Grayson. And so she nursed Dick Grayson back to health. But here's another little point. She has to bring Dick Grayson with her every single day to work. And when we recently went down to Jacksonville to visit my family, she came down with us, brought Dick Grayson with her. It's great. She has like a little carrying case that she slips over her shoulders. Looks like a book bag. And there's like a little bubble, like a window that the cat looks out of. It's really pretty funny. The reason that she does that, Barry, tell me if you've ever heard anything like this before. Because of the injuries the cat suffered when they first brought it in, The cat cannot go to the bathroom by itself.
Oh.
The cat cannot go, cannot urinate and cannot defecate by itself. My daughter has to manipulate the cat so the cat can pee and so the cat can poop.
Wow.
That's some love for an animal right there. And that's really, that's going above.
Devotion.
That's going above and beyond the call right there. So shout out to my daughter for
all those
things and for passing the love on. So hopefully, you know, your kids will have seen the love that you have for Ozzy and for Mr. Noodles. And when they grow into the prime of their adulthood on their own, they will see about rescuing an animal too. So, okay, that's enough for that. For all you people out there that fucking hate dogs. I'm sure there's...
I need names. If somebody hates dogs, Jeff, we need names.
Yes. So, Barry, let's now talk about the documentary that's on Showtime. We both have had a chance to watch it. The Comedy Store, a fantastic, fantastic documentary. A five-episode documentary. The first three episodes, I could not have loved anymore. The last two were good, not as strong as the first three. Tell us about the documentary, Barry.
Yeah, why don't we break it down episode by episode? So I'm going to agree with you, too. I think the first two were my favorite. I liked three and four. I liked three better than four. Five was kind of a wrap up, but we'll go through it. I liked it, but the first two just not, you know, you're talking serious home run. But as overall, this was really a fantastic documentary. So let's go episode by episode, Jeff. So the first episode, called "Saw You Last Night on the Tonight Show," I just thought, you know, I think I was 5 minutes into this and I was like, this might be the greatest thing I've ever seen. They're showing you what it was like at the Comedy Store, which really was the premier comedy club in America at that stage, and really for years, and still maybe in some ways. But you know, you look at the guys that were there, Richard Pryor. It really focuses big on Freddie Prinze, and Freddie Prinze, for all intents and purposes, was the first big star to come out of the comedy club. Got his shot on the Tonight Show, then obviously did Chico and the Man with Jack Albertson. But you know, he went through, you know, some real serious stuff when he wasn't the flavor of the week anymore and committed suicide. Now, what was he, Jeff? It was mid-20s, early 20s?
I'm thinking like maybe 21, 22 years old.
Yeah, it was really odd because he certainly looked like he was in his 30s. He didn't look like a kid, but he was like 22, 23 years old, committed suicide. It's a tragic story. God knows what would have happened to him in his career.
I will just say, I don't mean to interrupt real quick.
No, no, please.
The whole documentary is worth it just to hear the Jimmy Walker story about Freddie Prinze. I don't want to break kayfabe on the story, but it's a must listen because apparently Freddie was a little jealous of John Travolta, and Jimmy Walker tells the story. And when you get to it, you're going to laugh your ass off.
Yeah. And without giving away what Jeff just said, he is right, because this is, I think when we talked with Sweet Lou about this and we talked about it off air, this was the story you told Sweet Lou right away. Like, this was, you're not going to believe it. Just to say, it was, so Freddie Prinze was, I guess, and I'm not going to tell the story. Freddie Prinze was a little disturbed and upset that he was no longer the teen heartthrob, but John Travolta, who was riding the wave of things like Saturday Night Fever, was, and had some animosity towards John Travolta, and I'll leave it at that. But, you know, Freddie Prinze, Richard Pryor, Jimmy Walker, these were the early stars of the Comedy Store, and they're really portrayed in a very honest, honest light, which I like. But at the same time, this is so intriguing to watch and to watch what was taking place. The second episode, this is when I realized, okay, I was hooked. So this episode, which features our guest this week, Jeff, the great Marsha Warfield, this was the episode called The Strike. And this was something I never knew, but in, I think it was 77, 79, I forget exactly what year, the writers and the talent, the majority of the writers and talent went on strike. And apparently Mitzi was not paying any of the talent on stage. They would just come, they would do their sets, And they were not receiving any sort of monetary compensation, whatever. Mitzi was, you know, basically utilizing it as, well, you come on here, possibly Johnny Carson sees you or his talent scouts. They bring you on the show. You could get a TV show. And look, a lot of famous people came out of the Comedy Store. Absolutely. But the flip side of that, Mitzi Shore was making upwards of about $100,000 per week. And that was between ticket sales and food and liquor sales. So there was definitely camps on both sides that, you know, some people said, well, Mitzi is, you know, she's very supportive. She gives you an avenue that you can display your talents. We should be grateful. Other people felt that, well, Mitzi's making, you know, she's making several million dollars per year. And we're talking about the 70s. God knows what that would translate into now. You know, and she's not sharing any of that with any of the talent. That's kind of fucked up. I was kind of that camp. Like, you know, people aren't going to the store to drink and eat. They do that while they come to see the comedy. It's the comedy that's actually selling the tickets. These people should be. But you did have some people that that were not not really a part of that. Buddy Hackett was one that actually went on Carson and was talking a lot of shit about these comedians. And I think basically called them ungrateful. You know, again, Buddy Hackett that probably had $10 million in the bank at the time. So certainly easier for him to do it. And it did seem that Johnny Carson was also siding with Mitzi Shore. But then you had guys like Tom Dreesen, who was a semi-famous comedian, you know, going back in the 70s and the 80s. And he was, I think, super close with Mitzi, but he kind of led the spearheaded the whole movement to strike. And he's hasn't been back to the Comedy Store since, I believe. So this is really, I thought this was the key episode, the second episode. And, you know, again, the great Marshall Warfield is in this episode, but it really lays out the strike and the impact that the strike had. And it does appear that there were two different camps with this, that the camp like, fuck you, pay me. In the other camp that was Mitzi, you know, I'm going to be loyal to you. Interesting, because I don't remember this from the documentary, and maybe you do, Jeff, but the guy that did it, Mike Binder, is it Binder, Binder? I don't know how to pronounce it, but I think it's Mike Binder. But he actually crossed the picket line, and he actually was one that sided with Mitzi when all this was taking place. But to that point, he had a fallout with Mitzi years later, and he was also banned from the comedy club, and it was over nothing. They were able to work it out, and he went back and did that. So what did you think of the second episode?
Well, no, I mean, obviously, when we get to our conversation with Marcia, I referenced this episode, and Marcia lets me know in no uncertain terms what she felt about the issue. And just to be clear, the point I was trying to make was, what exactly did appearing at the Comedy Store mean as far as potential future earnings for a comic? You know, did it, you know, guarantee that if someone saw you, you'd get a spot on Carson, you'd get a spot in Vegas, or maybe as a supporting character actor in a movie? That's what I was trying to get out of her. And I think she misunderstood what I was asking, and she let me know.
but it, realistically, can you, and again, I'm on my couch right now. You're sitting in a computer chair. Can we accurately place ourselves in the shoes of these comedians as they're watching a woman who had no prior experience in this field whatsoever? And this is not a knock on Mitzi Shore and as far as what she was capable of, but, you know, she basically in the divorce settlement got the Comedy Store. This wasn't in her wheelhouse. But she's turned this into a business where she's making six figures a week in the 70s. Toss the fucking comedians a bone. Toss them something. It isn't like stand-up comedians back then, unless you were a Richard Pryor or somebody. For the most part, how much were these people going to get going somewhere else per night anyways? $25, $50, $100 if they were lucky? We're not talking great amount of money, but how do you in good conscience, and she is dead, so this is a rhetorical question, but how do you in good conscience, you know, make, $4 to $5 million per year in the 70s, and you're not paying the talent on stage? That's kind of fucked up, right?
So my question to you is, Is that a worse offense by Missy, or is foisting her son Pauly Shore on us?
Well, okay, and I like that question. So let's talk about Pauly. So Pauly is a lot of people. So let's go back. Pauly kind of hit it around 1990, somewhere right around there in the early 90s. And I think he was on MTV, which kind of got him a lot of exposure. He made several movies, but he had this character that was kind of like a stoner California, you know, just a, I guess, a moron, but with a heart of gold. And I never hated Pauly Shore like a lot of other, like Biodome. I can watch Biodome on endless loop. I like Biodome, but he, as a stand-up comedian, he wasn't terrible, because I actually saw him. He wasn't terrible. But here's the bigger question. Did Pauly Shore, when you watch this documentary, Pauly Shore grew up at the Comedy Store. His babysitters were the other comedians. His mother would, as a small child, his mother would bring him to work. And he was there every day. This is what he did.
Imagine having Sam Kennison as your babysitter.
Yeah, exactly. Did he ever have a shot of any sort of normal life after his child? And granted, it may have been the greatest childhood ever. I don't think he ever did. But I don't hate Pauly Shore. But how did you feel Pauly comes off in this documentary?
No, he didn't come off bad. I will take the opposite camp. I was never a fan of Pauly Shore. I'm sure there are people out there that are listening that love the guy and think that Biodome is the funniest fucking movie. Or, you know, what is it? I'm in the Army Now or something.
Yes.
Where he's in the, you know, and then there's the one where he's a juror at the courthouse. And I'm sure they think it's fucking hilarious. I just didn't get it. I mean, trust me. There were other people in this movie that I totally got. I was a huge fan of Pryor and Letterman and Carlin and some of them come off, Sam Kennison, they come off great in this, you know? And then there's others that I see and I'm like, man, I never really got their act, you know? And, you know, Barry and I were talking before we started recording about the fact that there are comedians out there that have a very narrow window. And during that narrow window, they could be like the most famous comedian in the world. And I referenced Dane Cook. 10 years ago, Dane Cook was the most famous comedian in the world. A couple years back, Sebastian Maniscalco was the hottest shit in the fucking country. You know, this happens. There are ebbs and flows. Sam Kennison, when he died, was humongous. I mean, just, you know, that whole, you know, and people love that shit, you know, but that window closes. And if you don't have something else to add to your act or make separate and come up with a new part and parcel of your act, you're not going to go anywhere, because eventually people get tired of the same fucking routine. I'll tell you something I didn't think about, and I'm saying this, it's kind of sacrilegious, but I wonder if he had not died, if that wouldn't have happened to Belushi. Because if you think about it, Belushi, and maybe it was more having to do with his substance abuse issues, Belushi was like getting offered very minor stuff when he died. And that was part of why he was so depressed, was he was getting, I want to say the movie that he was looking into was they were going to do a movie version of the book, The Joy of Sex, and told from a funny point of view. But, you know, like, think about it. Belushi, after he did Animal House, after he did, you know, not Caddyshack, what was the other one? The Blues Brothers and all that. Yeah, Blues Brothers and all that stuff. I mean, he had done, like, Continental Divide. He had done Neighbors, which was not really well reviewed. I liked it, but it wasn't really a strong, didn't make any kind of money. Yeah, 1941, which got horrible reviews. Yeah. So was the window of opportunity for John Belushi closing? I don't know, you know. But I'm just saying it's a possibility, because that window for comedians closes. Jim Carrey's window was open for a long time. He made a lot of funny movies. Then, like a lot of comedians, he decided he wanted to be a serious actor. And guess what? Jim Carrey's not getting $10 million for a movie nowadays. You know, it's just like one of those things. You have to grab the brass ring while you can, I think, Bear.
No, Jeff, you're 100% correct.
Check.
There are few people, and let's talk about comedians, stand up, people who are basically, you know, the organically were stand up comedians that morphed into either movie roles or TV roles. That is a very small window. And even Richard Pryor, look, George Carlin and Richard Pryor might be the two biggest stand-up comedians of all time. I don't know. That's certainly debatable. But certainly, if we're looking at the the birth of stand-up comedy occurred in the 70s. I know Lenny Bruce and everybody that existed before, but these were the two, I think, that brought it to the forefront. And George Carlin, obviously, though he's a legend and was a legend, he didn't do a whole lot, you know, the Bill and Ted movies and things like that. But even Richard Pryor, prior to his death and really before he got really sick, you know, he wasn't making these blockbuster movies any longer. You know, that everything had calmed down. So you're right about that. I will say, Jeff, you know, I did like the third episode also, which was The Wild Bunch. It was Kinison, Dice, Jim Carrey, Damon Wayans. Jeff, what this episode talks about, which I really found was interesting, was when Mitzi Shore was sick, she wasn't at the club, four comedians essentially took over and fucked everybody else. It was Dice, Eddie Griffin, and who were the other two, Jeff? Do you remember?
Oh, that's a perfectly reasonable question. Let me think.
I actually searched online and I couldn't find it, and I didn't have time to go back and rewatch the episode. In a nutshell, there were four comedians that decided to take over the Comedy Store when Mitzi wasn't there. It was Dice, Eddie Griffin, and two other guys. And they would actually go up and they would do 3-hour stand-up shows. Now, that if you've ever seen comedy, 3-hour stand-up shows.
Was Kinison one of them?
I don't think so. I don't think they said Kinison, though it might have been, but I don't think so. But maybe it was.
Howie Mandel, maybe?
No, it wasn't Howie. Howie's too. He's one of those good guys. But Eddie Griffin, and this is where I'm going to go with it. So they were talking, and they obviously pissed off a lot of other comedians because people would show up to do their set. And then they would find out they've been bumped because Eddie Griffin is doing a 3-hour set. And he only did a 3-hour set to fuck everybody else. And apparently they would actually go up there and like lean up against something and just go, what's new? Nothing. Like they weren't even doing stand up. And there was resentment from a lot of the other comedians that I believe still exist to this day, because Eddie Griffin is not in any of these like group settings or anything like that. But Mike Binder confronts Eddie Griffin with this, and it gets a little testy. And that I thought was really interesting. And I knew Eddie Griffin from those the Rob Schneider male gigolo movies. And I thought he was funny.
Deuce Bigelow male gigolo.
Yeah, but I never understood. I thought he came off bad. Doesn't come off as funny and just kind of comes off as a dick. The fourth episode, Joe Rogan, and I wasn't crazy about it until they get to Joe Rogan confronting Carlos Mencia on fucking stage and basically calling him a thief. And they show it. And this had to be shot by a fan that night with the phone or something. That was riveting footage, Jeff.
Yeah, that was great stuff. No question about it. And Carlos Mencia, he's not exactly drawing him in these days. Go figure.
Yeah, that was great. Joe Rogan for confronting Mencia, and honestly, go out of your way to find this, gets a 7-year ban from the Comedy Store in just in the last couple of years has returned. But Carlos Mencia was a big deal. There's another flavor of the week, Jeff. Sure. Had his own TV show, Mind of Mencia, on Comedy Central. Apparently was stealing material from everyone left and right. It's acknowledged by everyone. They have the proof. They've got everything. Carlos Mencia, I did a search, and he hasn't done shit in the last few years.
And there were comedians that would not appear on stage if he was there in the club because they knew he would be stealing their bits.
They would, if they saw that Carlos Mencia was there, they would only bring out their older material. They would never debut anything new because of that. The fifth episode was kind of the wrap up, deals with Mitzi's death, the impact it had on the comedy club. And then they discussed the birth of a bit, how you get going. It was a good way to end. I honestly, if I was doing this, and we should say too, Mike Binder was not a documentary filmmaker. I believe it's his first documentary. What I would have done, I would have focused more on the first three episodes in the early years. I wouldn't have gone you know, to Joe Rogan. But again, he only probably had five episodes. But give me more time. Give me additional episodes. I want to see more Pryor, Prinz, Kinison, all that shit, because that to me is unbelievable. With that being said, Jeff, if I was going to rate this on a scale of 1 to 10, this is probably a solid 8.5.
I think that's very fair. I think the first, as you said, the first three episodes are really, really strong. And it's kind of starts, the Rogan one is good to very good. And the second or the last one is average to good. But the first three definitely do not miss. And the fourth one don't miss just for the confrontation between Rogan and Mencia. That's classic stuff. So now, Barry, I tell you what, probably a good time now that we've done talking about the show. Why don't we go to our interview with one of the people that are discussed and talked to on the documentary, and that is legendary comedian Marshall Warfield. Let's go to that interview now. Barry, how cool is it that we are joined by, I'm going to go out and say it again, a legend in the comedy business. Barry, we are joined by the great Marshall Warfield. How you doing, Marshall? It's a pleasure to have you with us.
I'm fine. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Barry and I have spoken. We made brief mention of it in a prior episode. We have both had a chance to watch on Showtime the documentary. It's a series of five episodes. It's called The Comedy Store. And Marsha is featured there as someone who had performed at The Comedy Store. And so we wanted to talk to you about some of your memories of working there and some of your memories of life on the road as a comic. It's just an honor. So first tell us, when were you approached about appearing on this this special as they did a documentary about the history of the Comedy Store?
I talked to Mike about a year or so ago. Okay. I hadn't spoken to him in 30, 40 years, who knows, but it's been a while. And at the time, the focus was more, and the focus of the interview was more about the comedy strike at the Comedy Store. And so we talked a lot about that.
Gotcha. So touching on that too, Marsha. So I thought this was just a fantastic little mini documentary here with the five episodes. Of course, at the end of the fifth episode, I wanted another five episodes, which is always the sign that you're really enjoying something. But so one of the things I think I was really shocked about, and the best episode, and I'm not blowing smoke up your butt with this one, but the best episode was the second episode. Yes, you were heavily featured in that episode, but there was about the Comedy Store strike, the writer's strike that occurred, and I don't think I ever knew about this prior, and there was a couple of things that were really brought out there that Mitzi Shore wasn't paying the comedians, yet she was making somewhere upwards of around six figures a week in liquor sales and other ticket sales and things like that. So what was the reaction? Obviously, there was a strike. Buddy Hackett actually went on television and defended Mitzi and said that she shouldn't have to pay. So what was the general consensus at the time, not only towards Buddy, but in general towards Mitzi? Was there a lot of animosity, or was it more of a situation where I wish my mother would get things under control?
That depends on who you talk to.
Yeah.
Some people were in the fraternity, shall we say, that Mitzi was became a sort of mother hen to some comedians. And so rather than pay anybody, she would give them jobs around the club. And or I think there was a place that you could crash and all that kind of stuff. Those of us who had come from another kind of hustle, well, like, bump all that. I don't need no mama. I want my money. I need to get paid. And so there was a bit of a schism there about that. I was in the pay me camp because when I got to Los Angeles in 1976, Mitzi did not own the Comedy Store. Mitzi owned the name, the Comedy Store. The room that the original room was part of Art LeBeau's club. And she got it basically free from what I understand. And all she got was the door. They got the drinks and the food. And so she went from that to buying them out, opening the main room and featuring acts, you know, and you had to be a feature act to work in there. And nobody's getting paid. She had a club in Westwood. She had a club in La Jolla. And she had condos down in La Jolla. And I'm like, you know, you're making a lot of money and nobody's getting paid. This is insane. And so we went on strike.
So just, I'm just curious, and for the record, I completely understand and agree with your point of view that, that people should have been getting paid. But an appearance at the Comedy Store when it was at its height and you had all those people, you know, you and Letterman and Pryor and different people like that coming in to the club. How much, what's the word I'm looking for? How much was that worth to your career to, you know, have Marsha Warfield on the sign at the Comedy Club? You know, I mean, obviously that could lead to appearances on different shows, the Tonight Show or that or like that. How much would an appearance at the Comedy Store mean to the career of Marsha Warfield?
You know, that depends. You want to know in real time or in retrospect?
No, in retro and looking back, was it something where you weren't getting paid, but down the road the money you were going to get was going to make up for the fact that Mitzi hadn't paid you, or do you still think, you know, I'm probably not making I'm not vocalizing it good.
I'm 100% pay me. I'm union straight up. I've been in unions my entire life.
Oh no, and I understand that.
Was union. I believe if you're making a profit, you should pay your workers. Now, it just doesn't seem to be a no-brainer. And so I was very much in favor of the strike. I'm very glad that they got money. And in fact, I think the comedians should make more. They started cutting back on what they were paying as soon as they decided that they were going to pay. So I think that given the work that the comedians put in, and the work it takes to get on that stage, it's not like you can just go up there and goof around and be from off the street. There's a whole lot of processes you have to go through. And so given all that, everybody who hits that stage deserves to be paid, because everybody who hits that stage has put in a lot of work.
Yeah, Jeff, I would have to. I got to agree. And as I was watching this episode, when I saw that the comedians weren't being paid, that they were going up doing it for free, but yet Mitzi was making six figures a week on a good week, that was a little disheartening. At the same token, people weren't going here just to have a cocktail or a steak. They were going to see comedians. Just seemed weird to me that, you know, that wasn't happening. But so, Marsha, just going back a little bit, you spent a lot of time at the Comedy Store, obviously, and we do want to talk about your career as well. You were, I'm have to assume, extremely close with Richard Pryor. And even though it was a short-lived show, the Richard Pryor Show, you actually had a hand, not just as a performer, but if I'm correct, you were also a writer on that show, weren't you?
No. I'm sorry. Every time people ask me that all the time, I don't know where that came from. No, and you have to understand, most comics did not get featured during prime time so that they could be seen by whoever might be in the club that night. Most of us didn't get that. And most of the black comics didn't get a chance to get on until after midnight. And if Paul Mooney showed up, we didn't get on then. And if Richard Pryor showed up, he didn't get on. So it was there were a lot of nuances that add context that people don't generally know. And so we would be waiting for, and Richard was a superstar at that time. He had just ascended to superstar status. I mean, he had just done Saturday Night Live, which was brand new and blew up, and those iconic sketches were brand new and just born. And he's doing films, and his albums are breaking records. He's headlining concerts, which was rare. Comedians to that point pretty much were opening acts. We aspired to be opening acts in Vegas or for a particular singer or whatever. For the comedian to be the headliner in a concert was not the norm. And so Richard is doing these kinds of shows. He was the comedy god. So we would sit in the back and just watch him. Then he and Paul were very close. And when the show got picked up by NBC, because it was a pilot first that I wasn't involved with at all, but when it got picked up to series, they needed to cast the show, and Paul recommended comics from the Comedy Store. And it ended up working out, and Richard said, well, let's just use this pool. These will be our regular ensemble. But when we first got the gig, we had no idea that would happen.
Yeah, one of the great things about the documentary is it's got some clips from the Richard Pryor Show, including one with Richard and Marsha, that classic scene where you two are at a restaurant eating dinner in tables by yourselves, and you're sort of making eyes at one another from across the room. Very, very funny stuff.
Had no rehearsal, had no script, and I had no experience. And they told me, the page said, Richard and a beautiful woman sit across from each other and seduce each other with food.
Yeah, it was really good stuff. So I'm curious, when you look back at the people that were at the Comedy Store when you were there, obviously you hold Richard in extremely high esteem, maybe as the all-time greatest stand-up comic. Who was somebody else? Give me two or three other names that you really held in high esteem.
Me.
I probably should have said excluding yourself, of course.
Yeah, I really like me. And so, at the time we were all kids. We were all new. I like to say we were all too stupid to be scared. So some of the people who had broken out and were breaking out at that time were like Jim would. Freddie Prinze was still alive when I first got to town, but I don't remember him doing the store as much as the improv. But Jay Leno was there. Letterman would MC. Mooney was there. John Witherspoon. Elaine Boozler. Robin came later. That was pretty much the lineup as far as I can think of some other guys, you know, Kip Adada and who else? Argus Hamilton and I started the same night. Jeff Altman was there. Jeff Altman was there. And that was Denny Johnston, Johnny Dark. Now, it wasn't that many women. Lotus Weinstock and Shelley Bonas, Richard's wife, would be there from time to time. Sandra Earnhardt and Shirley Hemphill. Shirley had just gotten booked on What's Happening. So.
Wow. So in looking at your career too, and you've really, you know, you were in DC Cab, you were in the movie Mask, one of the, you know, you had your own show between 90 and 91, the Marsha Warfield Show. But you did a ton of TV appearances, Family Ties, Riptide, Cheers, In Living Color. The list goes on and on. But Night Court, and I was talking with Jeff and Sweet Lou about this too, Night Court is not just an iconic show on so many levels. I actually, it's playing in repeats, and it airs on a station that on the weekends does, I guess, mini marathons. It's 3 or 4 hours of just Night Court. And over the last couple of weekends, I have been watching it. The show holds up, where you watch a lot of shows that might be 30, 35 years old and they're dated, Night Court holds up from A to Z. Everything about it to me is perfect. And I got to say, Jeff, we've discussed television theme songs. That Night Court theme song is, once that gets in your head, that's not going away. But Marsha, yeah, it's true. Dun, 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 dun. You don't want to hear me, but believe me, it's fantastic.
Please don't sing. Really, please don't sing.
I won't sing. What? Nobody ever wants to hear that.
You know, there were words to that song.
What?
Yeah. We used to sing it on the set. Night Court.
Did you write those lyrics yourself?
No, we all did. We all contributed.
So you were, I didn't remember this. You were actually the third female bailiff. There had been Florence and Selma. And I don't know if my order is correct, but it was Florence and Selma. And then this past weekend, I actually watched your debut episode. So I love this show, and I now am on search to watch the entire series run from A to Z. The one thing that struck me about this show, and again, talking with Jeff and Sweet Lou, the castmates, there appears to be a real true camaraderie on this show. It appears to go beyond showing up, you know, at a set and performing. People truly appear to like each other on this show. Am I off base on that, or am I on the money?
No, we all pretty much got along. Most of us got along, and it was very familial kind of thing. A lot of, you know, in a show that goes 9 seasons, a lot of babies were born, a lot of, you know, families were met, and then parties were had, you know, when we worked together hours and hours and hours every week. So, yeah, it was very family-like. But Night Court was the stepchild of must-see TV. We were the bad stepchild, and whereas everybody else was trying to elevate their comedy, the sitcom, with their very special sitcom episode about muscular dystrophy or something, Night Court never did that. We had giant eight balls chasing people down the hall and rocket launchers. You know, fireworks. And an ape. You know, there was a resident ape. And we had animals all the time. We had gators and Mel Torme. We were the bad kids of must-see TV.
Well, as Barry and I can assure you, here on our own network, the Arcadian Vanguard Network, we are we call ourselves the bastard stepchildren of the Arcadian Network. So we were very similar to that. And as I was telling Barry and I were speaking about it, and he said, you know, he was telling me before we started recording with you, Marsha, you know, Night Court, you know, it's just unbelievable. And I said, you know, Night Court, I live Night Court because, Marsha, you don't know this, I worked in the court system in Fort Lauderdale for about 35 years. So all the storylines that you did on that show, trust me, I saw it in real life.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure I could think of a few you didn't see.
I didn't see anybody with an eight ball running down a hallway. That's true. I didn't see that.
Now, did you have an ape actually do play charades?
No, you're right. I didn't see that either.
He had to do breaking up is hard to do. So he did a break and pointed up and hit the table, and then waved his hands like, woo. So Harry had to say, break up hard voodoo. And that's how they got to breaking up is hard to do.
A Neil Sedaka classic, of course.
Yeah, that was Night Court. There were a lot of Chicago influences. Rhiney was from Chicago, and I'm from Chicago. So, that's how I ended up getting the gig. Well, one of the ways he already knew me and knew me as a fellow Chicagoan. So we sat and chatted, and at the time I smoked cigarettes, and we smoked cigarettes across my legs, and we I didn't read or anything. We just talked and got to know each other. And the next thing I know, I got the job.
Wow. And just also in looking at this too, one of my favorite movies, and it's this was a fun movie that came out in the mid '80s, was called The Whoopi Boys, which you were in with Paul Rodriguez. Now, I'm assuming your relationship with Paul, that you knew Paul going back in the '70s to the Comedy Store. Would that be correct?
The Comedy Store and the Bay Area.
And the Bay Area. Gotcha. So did you have to, yeah. You know, did Paul like call you on the phone and say, Marcia, I've got a part for you in this movie. And I love this movie too. I think I was 22 years old when this movie came out, somewhere right around there. But I remember when it hit cable, I would watch it all the time because it was really funny.
No, I didn't get a call from Paul. It came through my agent, but that was the second movie I did with him. He was in DC Cab.
That's right.
So we had worked together before, but no, we didn't have anything to do with casting each other.
So Marcia, if I could go back to the Comedy Store for a second, you know, while you were there and you know, you said you went through the strike and all that kind of stuff, did you make regular appearances coming back, or once you were gone, you were gone?
No, I didn't. I was not part of the comedy hangout club, the fraternity of the Comedy Store. I was one of those people who wanted to work the store. I wanted to work on my act. I wanted to get good and then get gigs. I wanted to get paid. I wanted to be a professional comedian. I didn't want to be an amateur working, trying to work my way up to some kind of big break. Superstar dream or something. It didn't make sense to me. And so I rarely talked to Mitzi. I rarely had any conversation with her. And the way I would get time, I would volunteer to follow whoever was the hottest guy that everybody wanted to go on before. So while everybody else was like, can I go on before you, Mr. Pryor? Can I go on before you, Robin? You know, because when you get done, everybody will be leaving. I was the one who said, I'm on. I'll follow you. Because I needed the stage time and I needed the hard stage time. It, you know, it's real easy to get used to doing it easy if that's all the only challenge you give yourself. And I was taught from the old people in Chicago that you don't pay attention to who was on stage before you, you know, because anybody who was through being entertained by that person left when they did. And everybody who stayed deserves the best show you can give them. So I would follow the, you know, big superstar acts and get stage time. And once the strike was over, I rarely went back. I started working at the Improv with Bud. Bud was always up front with me, and in fact, he was my manager for a while, and that was where I would work out my material.
I think it was pretty interesting on the documentary where I know it was said, I think more than once, was that you really didn't become a true working comic until you had gone up and bombed. Because that's when you really learned about the craft and you know, putting the time in. You couldn't just go and sort of just slough off and then walk on stage. You really had to work on your craft.
Well, every comic is going to bomb. You're going to bomb. That's going to happen. And I don't think that's the real test of a comic. The real test of a comic is, did you come back? Because it's very easy to quit after you bomb. There is nothing like a whole room full of people. They can either actively hate you and tell you, or they could just sit there and look at you like you're a species they've never encountered before. and either way is devastating to an ego. And, you know, if you come back, you probably got what it takes to stick it out. And it's been the thing that killed a lot of people's dreams and careers. They just don't want to face that again, man.
Yeah. So I saw John Witherspoon at a comedy club. I'm going to say it was about 5 or 6 years ago. And I think I can safely say it might have been the funniest stand-up I have ever seen. And John, I had tears rolling down my cheeks, but I wasn't alone. Everybody in the audience. So is there one comedian throughout your lifetime, Marcia, that when you've seen them, you just can't stop laughing? Somebody that really, really makes you laugh? Other than yourself?
Most comedians make me laugh. You know, I'm a pretty good audience. I try not to watch too many comedians because, you know, we're sponges. And so we end up being influenced by the people we hear. And I've wanted to keep my voice my own, and I don't want to be accused as taking people's stuff. So I stopped really watching, but I remembered Spoon from when he was doing Johnny Mathis impressions at the Comedy Store. And Spoon was the first comedian I met in Los Angeles. He worked the door. And when I went the first night, he's the first comedian I met. And so I've watched his show, his set, a gazillion times. And he's always been Spoon. He's always been up to the game and funny man. So, you know, I can't, if I have to pick a comedian who I first, besides Richard, who I first fell in love with, it was Flip Wilson. That was my first comedy crush. I loved Flip.
So, Marshall, let me ask you, how big a challenge, I'm talking about when you were first starting to break out as a comedian and getting recognized, how big a struggle was it for you as a woman in a industry at the time that was pretty much dominated by men? How tough was it as a woman trying to kind of break through that wall?
Well, I like to say I never did it as a man, so I don't have anything to compare it to.
Touché.
But I was, you know, there are some advantages. You know, it's a blessing and a curse. I like everything. You might think that being a slender, blonde, beautiful girl might give you an advantage, but every time she goes out on a call, she's going to see like 200 people who look just like her. And whereas if you're one of the few black comedians in town, it's going to be the four of y'all every time you go out on a call. So there were pluses and minuses. I was just, like I said earlier, too stupid to be scared. And so I just plowed on like this was what I was supposed to be doing. I rarely saw it as an obstacle that I couldn't overcome. You know, I was going to do stand up, and since there are no rules and there's no you know, organization chart where you put in an application and then you move up and you pass this grade, there's none of that. You make your career as you. You know, you forge your own path. So I figured all comedians have to do that. And that's pretty much how I looked at it.
Gotcha. So, Marcia, you and I have been Facebook friends, I think it's the last 6-7 years. And if I'm correct, too, I think you were one of the first celebrities to truly embrace interacting with fans, supporters, and people that want to argue with you as well on social media, which, you know, and what I like about you is you're very honest. You're very direct. You and I were on the same battle 3 or 4 years ago about corporal punishment on children and spanking and things like that. And I remember we had some real brawls. Have you found being vocal on social media is beneficial to your career?
Yes and no. Yes and no. I mean, I do it because that's who I am. You know, I'm not really trying in many ways, like a lot of people, you know, to monetize and, you know, and get their numbers up and all that kind of stuff. Some people think I have a lot of followers. Some people think it's pretty modest by, you know, TikTok standards or whatever. I enjoy let me put it like this. I love social media. I think this phone I'm holding in my hand is the greatest invention in the world. I think it's amazing to be able to talk to people from around the country, around the world, and hear their point of view and put forth yours and talk to people and listen to people and just interact. There's so much information at our fingertips. We have more information at our fingertips than all of the people in all the generations before us put together. We're just so amazingly blessed, and we oftentimes minimize this wondrous just development that allows us to all have a voice. And I think every human being wants to be heard. And what's beautiful to me about Facebook and TikTok and all the Instagram is that everybody gets to be heard. And so I'm on it not because of the career thing, even though I do get to interact with people I hadn't been interacting with before, which leads to opportunities and all that kind of stuff. But my biggest interest about it is just the ability to talk to so many different people I would never, ever otherwise meet.
So, Marcia, are you still out on the trail, working as a comedian, or do you have a place that you're the house comedian, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it? Anything you want to plug?
I was, but that, you know, COVID has
tell
kept
me
in the house.
Yeah, tell
and
me.
And so, I'm by choice and by circumstance, I'm not even looking. At the moment, I'm concentrating all my creative interests online, and I've recently did, like I said, discovered TikTok. I love TikTok, and I'm in the past few days, in fact, been making little TikTok videos, and they're so fun. They're only a minute, and you get to edit and enhance and play with stuff, and so. That and my next project will be a YouTube bio that I'm working on now and getting ready to put out. And that does enough for me right now until we get a handle on our health situation.
Absolutely.
Gotcha.
So.
Yeah. And Marcia, are you in Las Vegas? Is that correct?
Yes, I am. I am in Vegas.
Gotcha.
I've been here for
gotcha.
20
so
years,
Jeff and I,
I just started working about 6 years ago.
Gotcha. Jeff and I were just messaging as well. Are you on Cameo?
Yes, I am on Cameo. I am on Cameo as Marcia Warfield. I am on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, TikTok.
We probably should ask, is there anything that you're not on?
And I'm on all of them as Marcia Warfield.
There you
can find Marcia Warfield, Marcia Warfield's Comedy Cafe. I have a Church of Jesus page on Facebook. It's just under, well, we're building that up because I founded my own religion, the Church of Jesus. And I'm just having a ball playing with comedy.
So that's good. Well, listen, on behalf of my co-host, Barry, I do want to say how much we appreciate you coming on, chatting with us about your career, chatting with us about the Showtime documentary, still on Showtime. Barry and I cannot recommend this highly enough, an incredible look at the life and times of the comedians going from all the way back to the mid-70s until today. It's called The Comedy Store. Highly, highly recommended by the good folks here at Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. Marcia Warfield, thank you so, so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me and letting me ramble.
We love you, Marcia. We are absolutely thrilled that you joined us today.
Thank you so much.
Barry, Hollywood royalty, Marcia Warfield, you know, she was Roz on Night Court. How much fun was that?
That is, I got to tell you, look, we've done a lot of interviews. Some are good. Some are great. Some are super interesting. That was pretty fucking cool to be able to sit here and shoot the shit with Marcia Warfield. And I said something there. First off, she was singing the theme song to Night Court, Jeff. That's that right there. Like, you know what? This is our last episode. Boom, drop the mic. She just fucking sang the theme song to Night Court. Where does it get better than this? But I watched it again today. It's on this this show called this network called Laugh TV, and they air it 3-hour blocks in the morning. This is a great show. I am so happy that I've discovered it. It's now part of my routine on a daily basis as I go back and I'm watching Perry Mason, Matlock, Night Gallery, you know, Night Court. I'm watching all these old shows now on a daily basis and I'm loving it.
I told you that I just had a chance the other day to watch an episode of Kolchak, the Night Stalker, which is fantastic, that I think is on the same channel. And boy, Darren McGavin was so good in that role. And lots of great shows out there available. So Barry, now it's time. Why don't we talk about our match of the week? We are going to June 1st, 2004 in Boston, Mass. We are talking, Barry, it's one of your longtime favorites. No, not Daniel Bryan, but Bryan Danielson taking on the legend Jushin Thunder Liger and on the Rings of ROH. Barry, you had a chance to watch this match. Tell me what you thought.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it too. And what I like about this match too, we do a lot, you know, that it's either WCW, sometimes WWE, but this match is great because this is how you structure a match. There is a great build towards the end. You can almost sense that maybe a finish is coming, but at the same time, they're not overdoing it. We don't get 45 false fucking finishes, you know? So I really enjoyed it. So yeah, I've raved about Daniel Bryan, Bryan Danielson for years. But Jushin Liger's another one. You know, I go back to the early 90s and, you know, a guy that's on AEW television every week, Alex Marvez, was the first guy. You and I have known Alex since he was a kid, right?
Go ahead, ask him about Alex Marvez. Ask him about Alex Marvez.
Let's tell me about Alex Marvez, Jeff.
Who? That's my Austin Idol impression. Go ahead.
Very nice. But we you and I both knew him when he was barely in college. I mean, he was a kid. And Alex Marvez gave me a box of Japanese tapes that every single
tape. You're referring to wrestling tapes, I'm hoping.
Wrestling tapes, actually. But he gave me these box of wrestling tapes, and every single tape had a Jushin Liger match on it. And I became such a fan that he was my favorite wrestler probably at the time. I was making all these comp tapes of Liger. He was absolutely spectacular. So this is, in some ways, for me, it's a dream match. Liger a little older, a lot older, obviously. But I just, you know, when you sent this to me, I was like, yeah, this, I got to see this. Not a big crowd here, Jeff, as you mentioned, taking place somewhere in Boston. What would you guess? 600 to 800 fans, something like that.
It's not like this was in the, you know, the Boston Gardens or anything like that, but the crowd was smaller, but vocal. It was definitely a vocal crowd.
Yeah, I will say that. Absolutely. Commentary was interesting. You had CM Punk. CM Punk could have a career in doing commentary. Was the other gentleman Court Bauer?
Yes,
would that be correct? Yeah, I'm not quite as big a fan of Court Bauer. I believe he does MLW currently, maybe an announcer for MLW, but I know he's the guy basically running the promotion. Didn't love his commentary, but this is just a snapshot. I don't, you know, maybe he is great. I don't know. Liger doing a lot of his signature spots, which, and we should say too, even though Bryan Danielson, this was his home promotion at the time. Liger was the outsider. Liger is the guy getting heavily cheered, and Daniel Bryan, Bryan Danielson not getting cheered. But Liger's doing all of his spots. He does his surfboard, which I thought was great. Jeff, when you were here for the ROH show, which I guess is a little over 2 years now, Damon McDonald was not there. And Damon is a good friend of our old buddy, Eric Chulminski. He is he's a Japanese wrestling aficionado. So he and Eric are good friends. They're both heavily into Japan. And Damon was doing a podcast on Japan wrestling at one point that I don't believe he currently does. He is such a diehard Liger fan that he actually on his leg has a tattoo of Jushin Thunder Liger.
I've seen that picture. I've seen the picture. Eric took that picture of Liger looking at the tattoo on his leg.
Yeah. So whenever Damon is anywhere, you know, in proximity to Liger, the tattoo makes an appearance, Liger comments, and they've formed some sort of a friendship, a bond based off the tattoo. That's how hardcore of a fan that Damon is, though. Danielson giving fans the finger, and I like that. He might be the nicest guy in pro wrestling as well, which is interesting because he really truly is like a super nice guy. But I liked it. I liked the fact that he's walking around giving fans the finger. I thought that was great. The referee is Todd Sinclair. Took me a minute to realize, and when they finally said it's Todd Sinclair, I knew. Todd is a long-term employee of ROH, still reffing as a lot of the refs have left. Paul somebody or other went to AEW. He was with ROH for years, but Todd Sinclair has changed dramatically. That's why I didn't recognize. He looks like he's put on since this match, which is 16 years ago, probably a good 75 pounds. His hair is longer. The fans often refer to Todd as Barney Rubble, which is very accurate and always gets a chuckle out of everybody when they do. But Bryan Danielson does an airplane spin. I don't know about you, Jeff, but when I see an airplane spin like that, I almost had to like go up to the bathroom and start vomiting. I got so fucking dizzy. Danielson also does the cattle mutilation. That's a rough name, I think, for a finishing hold. But surprisingly, I don't recall him ever doing the cattle mutilation in the WWE. Even with it, they would have renamed it, obviously. But I don't recall him ever doing it. That is a spectacular fucking hold. Would you agree?
Yeah, the name of the hold, I can imagine Joey Styles in the ECW arena. Mutilation, you know, or something like that. But it's an interesting name for the hold. But I, you know what I liked about it? I like the fact that that Bryan Danielson in this match was playing almost. Now, this is something that I know there are people out there that are going to go, oh, God. He was doing like a Dory Funk Jr. subtle heel thing. You know, he wasn't overt in a lot of ways it wasn't like he was sitting there just, you know, kicking him in the nuts and stuff. He was doing little subtle heel moves. And that to me really added to my appreciation of this match.
Oh, absolutely too. And we should say too, the big difference between Dory and Bryan Danielson. I don't recall Dory ever after winning the world title, giving fans the middle finger or something, but
I'm sure in his mind he was.
Yeah. I don't know what goes on in Dory's mind, but yes, there is a possibility that would have occurred. Yeah, and you're right, though. In the ring, he's not full out like nasty heel. I think even the middle finger was in reference to the fact that they weren't supporting him and they were supporting Liger. Danielson, and I've said this before, Danielson is a modern-day Billy Robinson. You can watch him. You can watch the chain wrestling. I met Daniel Bryan 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, and I gave Zach a Christmas gift, which was a chance to go meet Daniel Bryan, take a photo, get an autograph. And he, honestly, the nicest guy you've ever met in your life. And I totally did not fucking ask him what kind of influence Billy Robinson might have been. Maybe it wasn't, but it certainly looks like it. Liger hits a brainbuster. Of course, I pop because the brainbuster was the finishing maneuver of Killer Carl Cox. And Jeff, as you know, I love Cox. Yes. And then Liger wins the match with a brainbuster, which is a suplex from the top rope and actually wins the match. I love this match. It's a fun match. What this match is did for me, Jeff, more than anything else, I am going to go back and I'm going to watch as much Bryan Danielson from ROH as I physically can, because just a spectacular, spectacular worker.
Yeah. And I know there's a match when you pull up this match on YouTube, you know, there's links to other matches. And one of them is a match with him and AJ Styles. I'm
sure. Oh,
I'm going to ask you a question. I don't know the answer to, I don't know if you know the answer. Do you know who his primary early trainer was?
Bryan Danielson?
Yes.
Well, he had two. The famous one that they always reference was Shawn Michaels, but I believe that training was minimal. And then Jose Super Sock Lothario, I think, was a guy that also spent a lot of time with him. But there was somebody else that was involved. And I think because the Lothario-Michaels connection, there was somebody else that trained him that it escapes my memory. Again, the legend is Shawn Michaels because it makes for a better story, but I believe somebody else had a bigger hand in training him, and that name escapes me.
Well, Shawn Michaels and Daniel Bryan, that's pretty good resume material for Jose Lothario, I will say that.
So, oh, yeah.
Now, Barry, why don't we go in a lighter direction? I think it's time, because the folks listening love when we play.
Jeff, hold on a minute. You didn't tell me what you thought about this match. I need to hear what you thought.
I thought it was, well, okay, there I go. I was getting ready to transition. Now you're interrupting me, co-host boy. I will say that I liked it as well. I am not familiar with a lot of ROH stuff. This was during my period where I was beginning to fall out of wrestling, was not following it as closely. So a lot of this ROH stuff, although I've been to a couple ROH shows, but they're not like ingrained in my memory. I think the only time I'd seen Daniel Bryan or Bryan Danielson before this was at, I believe he was at one of the one of the Charlotte Fan Fest. He had a match with somebody on the second day of the Fan Fest. They put a ring up in the middle of the hotel ballroom. And for the life of me, I can't remember who it was that he wrestled. I'm sure people that I knew that went there that I saw, whether it's a Mitchell or Hitchcock, I'm sure maybe they could tell me who it was that he wrestled. But no, this is really good. I really like the subtle heel stuff he was doing. I like Liger as a smaller guy using the palm strikes as this devastating offensive weapon that the other guys always sell for. That's good. To transition from the brainbuster to the brainbuster / suplex on the top rope for the finish, I thought that was pretty cool stuff. There wasn't a lot. You know, for a Jushin Liger match, this was not like a match that you compared to like a Young Bucks match or something like that, where there's, 10,000 different high spots. This was a much more grounded match. They did do topes and other moves and stuff like that. But it wasn't like ad infinitum. There were just here and there. And most of the stuff was mat work, which I really appreciated. And so I thought it was a really good match, too.
Yeah, it's and I'm whoever recommended this to us. Definitely a big thank you for that. But Jeff, now is the time. Sweet transition.
Now can I? Is it okay with you if I do that now, mister?
Now you can do it. Let's hear it.
Barry, it's time once again for our favorite game. It's F, Marry, or Kill. And again, Barry, I am being extremely kind, extremely generous to you, my friend. I have sent you the photos, and I think you will agree with me that I've been kind, would you not?
You've been really kind, yes.
So it is time to get out the hand cream, because we are talking F, Marry, or Kill in their prime. I'm going to tell you where this came from. I was watching a movie on TCM the other day. It's called The Killers. Here's the cast, Barry. We are talking such nobility in acting as Lee Marvin, Clue Gallagher, Ronald Reagan in his last role, amongst others, John Cassavetes, the great character actor Norman Fell, and the female lead, Angie Friggin Dickinson, who in this movie was smoking. So that is your first candidate, Angie Dickinson. Then we have from Viva Las Vegas and Carnal Knowledge, the legendary Anne Margaret. Daddy. And then, of course, from let's see, she was in shit. What was that movie? The Before Time movie.
The Roller Derby, right?
She was in the Roller. It was Roller Queen, I think. But what's the movie where she was like the cave woman or something?
Right.
I'm talking Raquel freaking Welch. And of course, the name of the movie is going to come to me at some point. So you got Angie in her prime and Margaret in her time, Raquel Welch in her prime. Now, you said before we started recording that you wanted to fuck all three of them, but you can't do that, my friend. You've got to play devil's advocate here. Who are you going to F? Who are you going to marry? Who are you going to kill? This is an elite, elite group. I was about to give you the ladies of match game. I backed out of that one.
Brett Summers. Kill, kill, kill. Yes.
Exactly.
I'm fucking Danny Jack Flag. Danny Flag. Oh my God.
Joyce Boulevard.
You should have saved that, Jeff. That would have been really funny. So
Raquel, Ann, and Angie.
Yeah, so quick question. So we're going off prime, which is great, yes, because in their prime, they're all lookers. Am I going off of personality, or am I just going off of physical looks?
You do whatever you need to do.
All right. This is a tough one because I've heard Raquel Welch is one of the biggest, most unpleasant people on the face of the earth.
I think in Seinfeld they were spoofing that.
They were. She supposedly, as gorgeous as she is, and still to this day, I got to be approaching 80, 75 or 80. She still looks great, but supposedly just somebody you never have to want to have to deal with. Physically, she's unbelievable. I am going to F Raquel Welch because it's one shot. I am going to kill Angie Dickinson, but my Lord, I am going to marry Anne Margaret in her prime, without a doubt.
I am going to give you a controversial answer here. I am killing Raquel Welch. Boom! I said it, and I can see the people posting right now on our Facebook group, Breaking Kippy with Badrin Mary, going, Badrin, have you lost your fucking mind? No, I have not, because I have a reason. But like you, I am going to marry Anne Margaret. Oh, daddy, was she hot in her prime. All you have to do, go watch a little thing called Viva Las Vegas, fans. That's all I'm going to say. Yes. And Carnal Knowledge, where she steps out of the shower, I say no more. But I am going to F Angie in her prime Dickinson, because if you've seen her in The Killers, the movie I mentioned, have you seen her in Rio Bravo with John Wayne? Who can forget her in Policewoman as Pepper? And she was kind of starting to slide down the prime at that point, but she still was hot. And who can forget her? I think we may have talked about this movie before. Dress to Kill. Speaking of shower scenes.
Yes.
Do you remember that scene?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. You have to appreciate a middle-aged woman who's on screen masturbating herself in the shower. So I'm gonna F the hell out of Angie Dickinson. So that is my controversial selection. Take it or leave it.
Yeah, you and the rest of Hollywood. But for me,
she did have a reputation.
She did. Nothing wrong with that. But I'm not going anywhere that Larry King apparently has been. So that's for me. I'm out.
Well, no, I'm getting her in her prime. Larry hadn't got it yet.
Okay, Larry didn't get it then.
Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, the rest of the Rat Pack with that. John Wayne. There were lots of rumors about Angie Dickinson in the past.
Yes. Good for her.
So, Mary, as we begin to wrap up the show, I have one last little bit of stuff to talk about. I reached out to you the other night and I said, did you get a chance to watch the AEW show? And I believe you told me that you had seen the second half of the show. You didn't see the first half. So did you miss the promo with Sting and Cody?
I did. And I heard it was fantastic.
I texted you and said, words I never thought I'd hear myself say is, wow, that was a home run promo by Sting. That's part of the reason why I wasn't a huge fan of Sting back in the day, was because I just thought Sting was a guy. He had a lot of athletic ability, but he was never, to me, a promo guy. And that promo he cut with Cody standing there, I thought was really good stuff. Again, my only question is, he's 61 years old. How much are you going to be able to do with this guy in the ring? You know, I mean, if they do one of these things where they turn him into a Noki about 1988 or 89, where, you know, he's a tag team wrestler in a 30-minute match, he works 2 minutes, comes in, does the high spots and gets the hell out of the ring. Well, okay. But if you're going to ask that guy to work a single match where he goes 20 minutes, I think it's going to be really exposed and it's bad news for the company. So then the other thing I was going to mention, did you happen to see the angle with Brandy, our favorite Brandy Rhodes, and Shaq?
Yes, I did.
So my question to you is, and I really don't want to be that guy that every week has something negative to say about Brandy Rhodes, okay? But if you get a star of the magnitude of Shaquille O'Neal to come on the show, why are you wasting him with Brandy?
So a couple of things with that. Apparently, so I saw what the ratings were, but apparently the segment with Shaq was the highest rated AEW segment in the television show's history. So as much as I hate that you're bringing on a celebrity that there's no legitimate reason for, it makes no sense, it does draw casual viewers and gives you a higher rating. Does that translate into next week? I don't think so, because I think that casual viewer is not going to return. But if you're trying to sell advertising space, I would assume that it does help. I'm with you, Jeff, on the fact that we don't need, and it isn't that I hate Brandi Rhodes. It's that she is not being utilized correctly in the fact that it needs to be minimal appearances, and what she does needs to be impactful. They've given her, she's had how many different roles on this show? She's been a heel, she's been a face. It just, and it seems to change every week. There's no continuity, but the continuity is Brandi somehow manages to get on television every week. This is a serious issue, and this is the kind of stuff that I think is going to hurt the promotion long term. They offer great stuff. There are some great wrestling that's here. There are some great tag teams. There are people that only want to focus on the negative, and there's not. There's a lot of positive in AEW, but by putting Brandi on television every week in roles that literally aren't going to sell a ticket, aren't going to move merchandise, aren't going to sell a pay-per-view. None of it makes any sense to me when it comes to her, Jeff, other than she's married essentially to the guy who's calling the shots, which is Cody Rhodes.
And here's
I feel like a dick for saying this as well.
No, and here's the thing. I think put in a proper role, she could be very effective because you know, the thing where she throws the drink in Shaq's face, very well done. I liked it. It was a good spot. She needs to be utilized. I'm going to put it as she needs to be Dark Journey to Cody's Dick Slater, because that was an incredible, you know, and I'm not just saying that because, you know, but I think in that sort of role as the heel valet, whether it's Dark Journey, whether it's Missy Hyatt, whether it's Precious, you know, a role where the bitch in her, if I may use that phrase, can come out into full fruition and she can blossom as a performer, because it's hard for anybody. Missy Hyatt was horrible as a babyface valet.
Oh yeah.
Dark Journey was horrible as a babyface valet, but she was gold as a heel valet. And so was Missy. And you know, I don't know. There's really not a lot of great, you know, Arnold Skolin was like the only babyface manager that ever managed to get over. And that's because he was with Bruno Sammartino, for God's sakes. So they're really not, they're doing a disservice to her by making her some sort of baby face manager, you know, and she's not even, it's not even like she's a female wrestler where she's a baby face and getting into it with this other person that Shaq was speaking up for, whose name I can't remember right now.
Is it Red Velvet?
No, it was it's the real tall black girl.
Is that not Red Velvet?
No.
The new one, she's real, she's muscular, right?
Yeah. She has,
I forget what her name is.
Yeah, I can't remember her name either. She reminds me a lot of the chick that was in the James Bond movie.
Grace Jones?
Yes.
Yeah. She looks great.
She has a good look to her. Very tall.
Yeah. You
know, great gimmick.
But muscular.
Yes. Speaking of great gimmicks, there is a smooth transition, Barry. Abaddon. Let's talk about Abaddon. I don't know if she can wrestle a lick, but boy, that's a great gimmick. It reminds me a lot of the character that came out of the TV set in The Ring, the movie The Ring. You know, the whole makeup with the two different color. That to me, if they really follow it to where, you know, the natural evolution of the character goes, that's a character, that's a woman that they can make money with.
I'm actually a big fan of Abaddon, and I saw somebody this week basically saying, she stole the gimmick. And my assumption is they would have thought about the two ladies in Impact, which is Sue Young and Rosemary, who do something similar. Abaddon's, in my opinion, is doing a different type of gimmick, because with Rosemary, she smiles a lot. Abaddon, and you're right about the second time this episode, Jeff, you're 100% right.
Thank you.
With Abaddon, because she's doing The Ring, she's got these jerky body movements like the girl in The Ring did. I do love the eyes. I love the makeup. She's got this gimmick down, but what I like about it, none of it's being played as comedy. This is being played as serious, and I think it works. She can actually wrestle as well. Like, she's actually good in The Ring. And here's the kicker. She's really attractive. Somebody posted a photo of her without makeup, and I was like, holy cow, she's actually beautiful. She's really, 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 really pretty. So I like her. I think there's money to be made with Abaddon.
And the last thing I'll say as we begin to wrap up the episode, do we both agree that asshole Kenny Omega is much better than aw shucks Kenny Omega?
Yeah, I mean, Jeff, we agree, and it seems like the internet also agrees. And the amount of hate for Kenny Omega in the last 2 weeks is significantly, dramatically lower than it was 2 months ago. So it seems like people are warming up. Don Callis, this is a genius move, pairing him up with a guy that can really talk, which is Don Callis. I love this whole crossover with Impact. I don't know how far it's going to go or what's going to happen. Our old friend Cash Money Penzer said to me last week, I guess I work for AEW now. So I don't know what that means. I don't really, you know, we don't know where this is going to go. But I think Kenny Omega, look, Jeff, you and I have been saying this for months. Kenny Omega, I believe, has rejuvenated his career.
Yeah, no, and quite frankly, I was like, what the fuck has this guy been doing for the last year? You know, the baby face, Kenny Omega was, I mean, it was a great tag team with Hangman Page, but it just, his character wasn't going anywhere. And let me just say this last thing about AEW. One of the things that they do that bothers me is they will have people that will splash. And when I say that, I mean like all of a sudden you're going, wow, this guy's really impressive. And then they kind of pull the reins back. And they've done this with Eddie Kingston now. And they've done it with a couple of Hangman Page is one of the guys that, you know, we were talking about this guy's getting ready to fucking break out. And now all of a sudden it's like, well, is he going to join the Dark Order or what? And maybe that's just a long storyline. I don't know. But they really seem to have like stopped his mega push. They stopped what they were doing with Eddie Kingston, which really disappoints me because I really like Eddie Kingston's character a lot. And, you know, that's one thing where they need to stop with the waves, you know, like where they go high and then it's down low and then they bring them back up. And like, how about a little bit of leveling off where people that are, you know, doing your company, you know, a lot of good, don't be like, you know, putting them back down to where we're not seeing them for a while. You know, like I want to see more of Eddie Kingston. I want to see more of Hangman Page. I want to see more of these guys that you're getting over. And then once you get them over, keep them over. I don't really think that's that hard to try to for them to figure out. And if it is, I don't know why. So anyway, well, that being said,
here's the problem that they have now, Jeff, too, is their roster is too big for this world.
Yes.
And it they're putting on essentially, I think, 3 hours per week of television, but they've got a roster that, you know, there's what, 60 guys or something. So the tag team of Jack Evans and Angelico, and I thought, you know, I remember both of these guys, the first time I ever saw Jack Evans was Mexico, but both guys were in Lucha Underground, which was really a great show that we should probably talk about one day. Gabe Daigle's going to like that reference because he was at a lot of those tapings in California. But Angelico and Jack Evans are two guys that can really, really go. And only until about 3 weeks ago, they weren't doing a thing. And they've been with AEW from the get-go. So they essentially had over a year where they were either doing an occasional job or appearing on the other show, which I think is AEW Dark. But we didn't see or hear anything. Only in the last couple of weeks have they started to get a push. I think this is the problem. Look, Hangman Page, you and I rave about this guy every episode. But, you know, at some point, you've got to give the rest of the roster an opportunity. And again, you know, if you've got 60, 70 guys, something's got to give with this. I would imagine at some point, you know, I don't know. I know Tony Khan is considered a money mark by a lot of people that I think don't truly always understand the wrestling business, seem to throw out the word money mark a lot. But we don't fully know, but I have a feeling that, Tony Khan, especially, you know, in relations to his father, there is some sort of business plan where they have got to make money. This isn't something that they can go into where they're losing hand over fist and paying these massive salaries and not getting any sort of return. So I would expect that we're either going to see cuts or something has to give. But here's the one thing I can't figure out. And when we had on Dave Meltzer, this was where I was trying to go with it. Vince McMahon, and we probably can talk about this at some point, Vince McMahon terminated Zelina Vega a few weeks back because she was not willing to stop doing Cameo and OnlyFans and all these little side projects to make money. You know, why does an AEW, in an effort to recoup losses, let all these guys do it, but essentially take the money from it? You know, they're working I'm going to guess, 1 to 2 days per week at this stage, and they're all making a lot of money. The company should be able to recoup some of this money.
Well, all I know is they've got 60, if your number's right, they got 60 people that they've got to find space for in amongst the times that Brandy's on. I'm just going to say that.
There you go. Exactly.
So that being said, I'll remind you that Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Barry, any last words before we go home?
I'm still moved by your story earlier, and I got to admit, I've told this story before, Jeff, and I don't want to belabor it, but I went and saw Death of a Salesman on Broadway with Brian Dennehy some 20 years ago with a group of friends, and then we were supposed to go out and party afterwards. And let me tell you, when I got out of the theater, I was like, I got to go home. And in some ways, I feel that way. I mean, I'm happy you said it, but that was a very sobering, very powerful and impactful story that really hit me in the gut.
I only hope that it affected Brandy that way if she listened. Okay, that's trying to make a little ha-ha. All right, yes, folks, until next week, on behalf of our producer, the sweet man, the chef, Lou Kippelman, and Mr. Barry Rose, myself, we appreciate you listening, lending your ears to us, and we will see you next week.